take it from a Muslim, where her country has banned these factions, have banned Islamists, have banned extremists, because we know the direct consequences of that. If you're not going to listen to the people who were actually affected by these factions and took action, who will you listen to? The thing with terrorism and extremists and all of those Islamist factions around the world is that they fear women a lot. The Islamic regime, like any other terrorists in the world, they know the true power of women.
Iran, at least, is insisting that in one way or another, they want to continue to control the Strait of Hormuz. Is that something that the UAE can live with?
Absolutely not. Just keep it simple. Absolutely not. It's an international waterway, and it will not be held hostage by any nation, especially not a terroristic nation.
Welcome to Mideast Horizons. The Abraham Accords are back, or at least back in the headlines. President Trump wrote on Truth Social that he expects Saudi Arabia, Qatar, even Pakistan to join the Abraham Accords. And he wrote that this would be the bring true power, strength, and peace to the Middle East. The level of such an Abraham Accords document would be unparalleled in its importance and prestige. It should start with the immediate signing by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and everyone else should follow suit. Now, it's clear both from President Trump's statements, but also from the actual actions of the administration over the past months, even over the past year, that President Trump is envisioning not just bilateral peace and normalization agreements like those that were signed between Israel, the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and to a certain degree, Sudan, in 2020 and 2021, but something much broader, a new U.S.-aligned regional architecture in the Middle East. And this isn't just rhetoric. There are things that are happening. So, for example, it wasn't widely noticed, but on January 12th, 2026, just before the, or a month and a half before, Operation Epic Fury and Roaring Lion, U.S. Central Command announced the establishment of a new Middle East Air Defense Combined Defense Operations Cell, a unit within CENTCOM headquarters in Qatar, bringing together 17 countries, presumably Israel as well, to coordinate air defense and awareness. And we saw this new Middle East Air Defense Alliance in operation during Operation Epic Fury in February, March, and April of this year. But it's not only on the level of defense. We're seeing renewed interest and actions in the India, Middle East, Europe corridor, a corridor of trade, energy, connectivity, information, bridging east to west from India to Europe and farther on to the west to the United States, which would be a U.S.-aligned network that could serve potentially as a alternative to Chinese, Iranian, and Russian-dominated transport networks. We see the PAC-SILICON initiative being led by U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Jacob Hellberg, which is meant to bring U.S. allies together in a alliance for AI supply chain security. And three of the early and key members of that alliance are Israel, the United States, and Qatar. But of course, the Middle East in May 2026 is quite different than the Middle East in September 2020 when the Abraham Accords were initially signed. Since October 7th, the ensuing multi-front war in 2023, we've seen that Abraham Accords ties on the diplomatic level have remained stable. We've seen trade ties continue to grow. So trade between Israel and its Arab peace partners in 2024 was higher than in 2023. And then in 2025, once again, it broke records and was higher than 2024. And in the first quarter of 2026, trade between Israel and all of its Arab peace partners is higher than in the first quarter of 2025. We've seen over the last few months, renewed investment and technology exchange. However, the post-October 7th war did have a highly negative impact on the people-to-people, civil society, war and peace engagements and interactions. They didn't disappear entirely, but they are at much lower levels than in pre-October 7th, although following Operation Epic Fury, Roaring Lion, we've seen a rise in that as well. And this is the situation now as President Trump aims to inject new momentum into the Abraham Accords and this goal of developing a new Middle East, an Abraham Accords 2.0, a new U.S.-aligned regional architecture that serves the goals both of stability and peace, and also vital United States security, economic, and technological interests in the Middle East and around the world. Well, to help us understand and analyze this new Middle East, we have a very special guest this week. Rauda El-Tanaji is a Emirati political commentator and geopolitical analyst, known for her sharp, unapologetic analyses on extremism, ideological warfare, and narrative control. She's widely recognized for her presence on social media, where her voice cuts through the noise, challenges dominant narratives, and confronts ideological confrontations without hesitation. She has spoken widely at the UN Human Rights Council, the Council for Foreign Affairs, the Hudson Institute, Georgetown, and numerous other prominent platforms. In this episode, we go into the future of the UAE, the GCC, Iran, the Abraham Accords, the conflict taking place in the region, but not just in the region, the broader conflict taking place in the Middle East, but also very much in the West, between those who support extremist regimes, ideologies, organizations like the Iranian regime, like the Muslim Brotherhood, and those that support a future and a pathway towards moderation, dialogue, and cooperation. This also was the topic of her first book, Andalusian, which examines how extremist organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood use selective storytelling and narrative framing to advance their ideologies. She's also a kart racing endurance racer, and we get into that as well. This is, of course, the Miskav Middle East Horizons podcast. I'm Asher Fremen, your co-host, executive director of the Miskav Institute for National Security, and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Miskav Middle East Horizons podcast is the podcast for anybody who wants to cut through the noise and go beyond the headlines to gain a deeper understanding of what is truly happening in the Middle East. We invite you to send your comments, questions, suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com, and we'll read them all, so please keep them coming. So without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Rauda El-Tanaji. Rauda El-Tanaji, I've been following your X feed for a long time, and it's a real pleasure to have you on the Middle East Horizons podcast.
Thank you so much for having me over. I'm excited.
You are a geopolitical analyst, a political commentator, and we're going to talk about the conflict that's going on right now in the Middle East with Iran, with the UAE, with Israel, and also about the wider and deeper conflict taking place in the Middle East, but around the world, between the extremists represented by the Muslim Brotherhood and the forces of moderation and progress going on. But before we get into that, I just want to read a news report. This is from the Emirates Motorsport Association organization. And it's talking about the UAE Motorsports team has showcased exceptional talent and determination at the FIA Motorsport Games of 2024 that took part in Spain. And then it talks about the karting endurance team consisting of Humaid Al-Ketbi, Ahmed Al-Hamadi, and Rauda El-Tanaji, which had an impressive finish. This achievement not only highlights the team's collaborative spirit, but also showcases Rauda as a remarkable representative of diversity within the UAE's motorsport community. Her participation serves as an inspiration for future generations of female athletes, demonstrating that the sport is accessible and inclusive for all. So that's pretty remarkable.
That took me by surprise.
Karting endurance. First of all, just explain to our audience, we might be able to feel like karting, these are like sort of very low sports cars almost, but that are on the ground, right? That are going around and around on a track.
Yes, it is. So basically, when it comes to endurance, I haven't done it in a long time. You just gave me flashbacks and I miss it.
How long is an endurance race?
So it depends. The one that we did in Spain was 4 hours.
Whoa.
But then you have the 12-hour race and then you have the 24-hour race. So it depends from race to race. And it depends, for example, in the UAE, my teammate did the 12-hour race. That was an amazing experience. I wasn't part of that because I don't want to say I quit, but I'm on a break. I'm on a break at the moment. But yeah, it's a very challenging, but oh my God, it's such an amazing experience. The rush, the adrenaline, the competition, a little bit of stress. Sometimes things get heated, you know, it's a race at the end of the day. You really want to win. And we don't settle for less than P1. So it gets challenging sometimes, but it's all part of the sports, and it's something I really enjoy doing.
I think it's incredible. Yeah. And I guess also the combination of endurance on the one hand, but also quick reactions
yes.
to changing circumstances on the other hand, probably also serves you well in these narrative battles that you're fighting online.
It does.
It's a different kind of arena, but similar skills.
You know, racing keeps me on my feet a lot of times, and similarly to politics, right? It's just, I have to react. I have to keep being on my feet and just keep thinking really quick as to what strategy I'll take. And so I think my racing background really helped in that sense.
I've been to the UAE a number of times, but not since the latest round of fighting, since Operation Epic Fury, Roaring Lion. And in this operation, the UAE faced, I think, close to 3,000 missiles, rockets, drones fired by Iran and its proxies at the UAE. I want to ask, what impact has this had? And the Emirati armed forces performed remarkably in terms
yes.
of their interception rates,
yes,
in terms
yes,
of their
yes.
home front defense. What impact has this had, though, on the Emirati society, Emirati youth, Emirati self-image and national identity?
Abdullah bin Zayed, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed, ABZ, said a very nice word, or a very nice phrase, and it says that we will not be blackmailed by terrorists. And that phrase alone changes mindsets around the world, not just in the UAE. I'm sure if I said this phrase anywhere else, for example, Israel, I'm sure Israel has faced extremists, you know, from Hamas since October 7th. And I think this is a common point between us and Israel, that we will not be blackmailed by terrorists. And so in terms of identity and in terms of how the youth felt, it's been amazing. You know, it's funny. It's actually a really funny feeling, because you can hear those missiles, right? You can hear the explosions. You can hear, like, Iran threatening, the Islamic regime threatening over and over again. But then you just walk out the house and there's absolutely nothing going on. You'd go to the mall, which is, for us, the mall is like, since it's with the heat and everything. So the malls is our go-to place. So you'd see the malls and they would be packed with people, you know, and it was during Ramadan as well. So some people were practicing their spirituality, their religion. They would go to the mosques and all of that. And with us, it was family gatherings. You know, Emiratis are really embedded. Our culture is really relies heavily on family traditions. And so during Ramadan, most families here would have consistent family gatherings throughout Ramadan. And so that never changed. And so the vibe that we felt overall was that, wow, our country is really strong, and this is such a brave move. And that just made us feel fine and made us feel like, hey guys, this is just like any other day. Let's just do it and let's move on. I was actually thinking at the time, I was thinking about like what KPIs I have to hit. I wasn't really thinking about the war itself. So work was normal, everything else was normal, and yeah, this was the general feeling in the UAE.
I think probably if you had asked Emiratis before the war, you know, is the country resilient? The answer would have been yes, but here you had sort of tested by fire, in the most literal sense, and the resilience was shown. Do you think there was also, in my many trips to UAE, the armed forces, the military, was never really a topic of discussion, very different than in Israel, where you have, you know, universal draft for many years, and it's very much sort of a topic of discussion. And then I got the sense from my conversations, from the online, that the centrality and the pride in the military forces also became much more center stage during this operation. Do you think that's correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's absolutely correct. We've always had a sense of pride in our armed forces, and we also have a program called the National Service, where once the boys graduate high school, they would be put into this program for about a year, 2 years. I'm not really sure on the timeline, and that just helps them be disciplined for the rest of their life, you know, teaches them discipline. It teaches them national identity, which is very important here in the UAE. So to us, we've always had pride in those forces. But then you just see you saw the war and you're just like, wow, our capabilities are beyond amazing. And of course, here with the armed forces, I have to mention our two martyred members of the armed forces. It was very sad to hear, and it really struck us emotionally. We're sad to see them go, but the UAE is built on resilience. It's built on resilience, and we're happy that we were able to showcase it.
We're speaking now when the entire world is following the question, is there going to be a deal? Is there not going to be a deal? Is it going, you know, every 5 minutes, there's another leak, there's another briefing, there's another report, there's another AI image that President Trump tweets out. I think he must really enjoy AI. I don't know. I don't know which platform he uses. But Iran, at least, is insisting that in one way or another, they want to continue to control the Strait of Hormuz. Is that something that the UAE can live with?
Absolutely not. Just keep it simple. Absolutely not. It's an international waterway, and it will not be held hostage by any nation, especially not a terroristic nation. So
you've spoken quite a lot, not just online, but also at the UN Human Rights Council and at various universities and policy centers about extremism, about terrorism,
yes,
about the Muslim Brotherhood, but not just the Muslim Brotherhood. What do you think that the West, media, academics, doesn't understand or gets wrong about the true nature of the Muslim Brotherhood and of these extremists?
Actually, thank you so much for bringing this up. I was going online doing some research yesterday, and I found out that the Islamic regime in Iran has lobbies in the West. And it has around, if I'm not mistaken, it has around 250 active lobbies in the West. And that is appalling to me. I don't see why a regime like that is able to, you know, have influence in the West and operate freely. It is very dangerous to keep that going. The thing with terrorism and extremists and all of those Islamist factions around the world is that They fear women a lot. The Islamic regime, like any other terrorists in the world, they know the true power of women. So there is a question worth asking. Why is it that every time Iran shakes, the women appear first? We've seen it in the 1999, where women stood at the center of student protests against repression. And then again in 2009, after the disputed elections, they actually became symbols of resistance during the legitimacy crisis. And then you have the 2019, where there are protests over the fuel prices. And what's beautiful here is that we actually saw a generation of women that are more angrier, they're younger and angrier and more brave as well. They're unwilling to stay silent. But then, of course, we know the 2022, the death of Mahsa Amini. So because of that, the Islamic regime knew the power of women. So then they decided to use women in their own propaganda, where the woman would color the missile pink. And then, which I found so hilarious. I was like, seriously, guys? And then they would bring in...
Code Pink probably liked it, but...
But then, and then you'll see, they'll bring in people like Bushra al-Sheikh, who's a UK propagandist. We all know what she does. She sells the Muslim Brotherhood agenda to the West, and then she traveled all the way to Iran to become an IRGC propaganda tool. And unfortunately to say, but this is a direct product of having Muslim Brotherhood and the media funded by external forces, and then the IRGC lobbies operating freely in the West. That is a direct consequence. And if that's not addressed effectively, I'm afraid that the West is heading into a very dangerous spot.
Your work and delusion deals with, I think, some of these delusions or illusions about the Muslim Brotherhood and about their narrative warfare. Can you explain to our audience sort of the central thesis and the central argument of the book?
Yeah, pretty much. I'll just start off with this. My book got a lot of attacks just simply because of the name. But then when you read the book, you'll actually realize that I'm not actually criticizing Andalusia as much as it is a it's a framework I used to explain what is happening in the West today. So there's a lot of fantasies when it comes to Islamists of wanting to conquer the West again, but they wouldn't do it in a way where that requires weapons and jihad as the way we know it. No, they would do it through the freedom of speech. You know, they would manipulate the freedom of speech into their own advantage. As I said, they would use the media, you know, to share their agendas. They would do the, the inclusivity meetings, for example, at work. You know, when they have, let's say HR does an inclusivity meeting to describe stuff, that's where they would use their agenda and their victimhood to start changing people's minds. And so I'm just showcasing in my book the different strategies they use and in which category they use it in. And I just basically expose them and say, hey guys, it's actually kind of more psychological than you think. It's not just a one shoe fits all, you know. It's like a, for every setting, there's a strategy they use. And they manipulate the freedom in the West. They manipulate the liberty the Western people have and the Western system has and what they rely on. And yeah, that's all to fit their agendas. And I'm like, okay, I get these, guys, I get these sentiments. I get the freedom of speech. I get the, it's very important to have it. It's a human right. But we also need to be wary of how these freedoms are being used against your own people. So that needs to be addressed. And so, my book is a warning to policymakers to be like, hey, guys, this is actually happening, and take it from a Muslim where her country has banned these factions, have banned Islamists, have banned extremists, because we know the direct consequences of that. If you're not going to listen to the people who are actually affected, who were actually affected by these factions and took action, who will you listen to?
So if you were standing at a lecture hall in Columbia or Harvard or any other university in the United States, what would you say to these students who are sitting there?
Be aware of what people are putting out and the messages they're putting out. Do your research. Do not blindly follow people. You know, there's a saying, or it's a meme on Instagram, which is the blind leading the blind. And I think in politics or in situations that are like that, we see a lot of cases where it's blind leading the blind. And then when you actually look at the case and you actually see the facts for yourself, you go like, wait, that is not what I was told. That is not what I was putting my blood, sweat, and tears into. That's totally something else. So do your research. Try to understand different perspectives. I think right now we have become so polarized in terms of opinions, in terms of politics, in terms of a lot of things. But it's important to listen to one another. And it's important to respect. And it's important to argue and debate. There's nothing wrong in that, with that. As long as it's not disrespectful, as long as it's not the screaming, as long as it's not the, the disrespect instead. Like, it's sort of like me. And I just forget your opinion. No. Come here, let's listen, let's discuss. We might reach a middle ground, or we might not, but at least I'll have your information and you have mine, and based off that we can do our research and grow from that. Yeah,
respectful, calm dialogue, like on X, you know.
I don't think X is a good platform too.
but it's an interesting question, because you've talked a lot about narrative warfare. When you look at X or any social media, and the amount of hate, but also the amount of bots and manipulation and now AI, do you think is it possible to win that narrative warfare battle, or is it sort of a lost cause? And I know you've taken a lot of heat online from people in Sudan, from people in other countries. Is this a battle that can be won, or is there even a hope for, you know, constructive discourse on these social media platforms?
Not really, in my opinion. When you know that these bots are being paid for by specific people or by specific, could be even specific states, well, what's the use in trying to argue back and forth with them, knowing they're just out there doing one thing, right? It's their task to do so. So I'm more of like, okay, I'll put my things out there. I'll put the facts, I'll put the, even my opinion, I'll put it out. If throughout the comments section or throughout the DMs, if I see someone who's more than willing to go back and forth with me, I'd be more than happy to indulge in that. But other than that, the bots and all of that, it's heavy, you know, it gets heavy sometimes. But then when you just know, oh, they're just bots, you know, or they could be misinformed or anything, they're just like, you know, what am I going to do about it? It's the internet. But then I'd also like to add one thing in terms of narratives and stuff. We talked about Trump earlier and his decisions and all of the things that are happening around circling Iran's war. Trump, in his book, The Art of the Deal, he spoke about the truthful hyperbole. It means basically you open with extreme demands to create momentum and psychological pressure, whether or not that is the final destination. So the goal is to shape the environment before negotiating even begins. But I think this is where Trump misunderstood the battle between the US, Israel, and the Islamic regime. He tried to sell the war strategically, not emotionally, whereas the Islamic regime, on the other hand, sold it psycho-religiously. They used martyrdom, resistance, symbolism, victimhood, identity. They understood emotion moves people faster than policy papers do. Trump understood the leverage, but the Islamic regime understood the narrative. And unfortunately, in modern conflicts, you know, perception is leverage too. And I think that's where Iran was able to leverage their narrative to the world, and which, in a sense, stunned an international action when it comes to the war.
I think that's a really interesting and important point about the differences in the way that the two sides presented and framed the war. Do you think that Iran's framing of the war had an impact beyond Iran itself? Was it able to inspire or impact Muslim, Arab publics or communities in other parts of the world? Or was it primarily for internal consumption?
I don't believe it was for internal consumption, because if it was for internal consumption, then we wouldn't see an internet blockout, right? Right now, it's been 85 plus days where where the Iranian people are out of the internet. So they don't really know what's happening right around the world. They don't know the narratives that are being put out there and which side is fighting what exactly. Well, what's being displayed online is particularly for the international world to understand and to take and to use. I believe the influence that the Islamic regime is trying to put out there is working on some nations. I believe that they use their proxies around the Muslim world to further their messages and their agendas. And this is where we're at right now. The mediator, the victim is the mediator, and then vice versa. And so there's a lot of gray area as to what is happening. And if we don't have, and it's playing into the Islamic regime's agendas, you know, have chaos, have no defined lines in the world and everything. And that's how they will be able to manipulate the system and get what they want. it's important in the Arab world and in the Muslim world, and even in the international community, especially with the failure of NATO. It didn't do much throughout the war. Unfortunately, it's a very sad thing to see. You know, a force as great as NATO simply just sitting on the sideline and waiting for everything to settle down, and then they'll take action. So, yeah, I believe the narrative being put out right now by the Islamic regime is affecting people. Even if it's not affecting states, it's affecting regular people. You know, I'll say it on X. I've seen it on X mainly, where I would get comments. I would just be saying, by the way, guys, there's an internet block, right, in Iran for the past so-and-so days. And this is not okay. This is a violation. You should, like, the regime shouldn't be doing that. And then I would have people from random countries, from different countries, attacking me for saying a fact. So that's how deep their influence can get. But that is both the beauty and the curse of storytelling and the narrative selling, is that it is effective if you want it to.
Let me ask you, and this might be a little bit sensitive, but there are many scholars and researchers who would argue that over the past decade, two countries that have been a major source of Muslim Brotherhood support, even propaganda, are Qatar and Turkey. The UAE has a complex relationship with these countries. If I'm not mistaken, Qatar's Al Jazeera is banned in the UAE. At least at one point it was.
It was.
Is it still banned? Can you watch Al Jazeera in Dubai or in Abu Dhabi?
I haven't checked, honestly. I don't watch Al Jazeera much, so I don't know. I believe it's on, but we do have other channels that are blocked effectively.
Do you think that's an accurate description regarding these two countries? And do you think, especially with Qatar, given the Iranian attacks on Qatar and also the reconciliation between Qatar and the other GCC countries, which took place in 2020 or 2021, do you think that then we might see a change in these countries' approaches to the Muslim Brotherhood?
I think everything changed after February 28th with the war. I think countries are calculating strategically as to how they'll move forward when it comes to these factions and to the terrorism and extremists. With Qatar, I think they learned their lesson. I remain hopeful. I'm optimistic when it comes to the Muslim Brotherhood, and then it comes to the Islamic regime and the way they were targeted. So I hope there would be a good future in that region by banning all kinds of Muslim Brotherhood activity and all kinds of extremism, and no more putting that agenda onto the media. You know, it's not effectively helping everyone but causing destruction. So that's in terms of the GCC or Qatar, to be specific. In terms of Turkey, I don't see they're stopping it. I don't see that they will be stopping anytime soon with their strategies in terms of the Muslim Brotherhood and their extremist factions. We've seen them in Sudan. They're still going. And so that is something to be addressed internationally. However, at the time, I don't think Turkey themselves will be taking action, just because as a direct consequence of the Iranian aggression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Sudan, which is just an unbelievable tragedy. Yes. And when I was in university, I was very involved in raising awareness around Darfur and bringing people from Darfur to speak. And then to see that, you know, the country descend into chaos and starvation and civil war again is truly, truly heartbreaking. And the lack of attention, to be frank, that the conflict gets is also very disturbing. I don't know where it is to push back, but I just want to sort of put a question to you. I visited Sudan, I visited Khartoum and other regions in 2022, if I recall correctly. I saw the incredible potential of the country. Also, people were quite aware that I was an Israeli, and I guess it was all the people that I met, from farmers to government officials, were very welcoming and very, very interested in the possibility of cooperation with Israel. Mm-hmm. I also met General Burhan, the leader, the military leader of the government, which is now locked in a civil war with the RSF, with the the rebel factions. I'd say when I met General Burhan, he was shortly after Sudan had joined the Abraham Accords. And I got the sense that he did want to move his country into a Western orbit. Obviously, we've seen since the Civil War started, them moving closer to Iran, being supplied by Iran. But from Emirati friends, Emirati commentators, sort of Burhan and the covered government are portrayed as sort of Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas. But then I ask myself, but if he, again, I only met him once. It's hard to form impressions from when you meet somebody one time. But if somebody was truly Muslim Brotherhood aligned, it's unlikely that they would sign the Abraham Accords. What are your thoughts on that?
Basically, you need to know that the army itself, there is the, what do you call it? The Bara' ibn Malik Brigade, which is a Muslim Brotherhood Brigade. So when you see that's happening, you see that they're there and they're operating, and then I've seen in that they would publicly televise the speeches that they would give, and they said, and it's many generals in the army would be like, yeah, so what if we have Muslim Brotherhood in our army? We respect them as such and we want them to fight side by side. Then that really defeats the purpose of wanting to mingle with the West and, you know, be progressive and such. Factions like that, their sole purpose is to have consistent destruction. They live off of that. They live off of the beauty of destruction. They glorify it. So when you understand that psychologically and that's their ultimate goal is to just have destruction and so they can remain on top, you'd say, well, maybe that's not what they want to do in terms of like progressing with the West, and he wants to take his country to the next level and all of that. When you have factions like that, it defeats all of the causes. So if you get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood and have a civilian-led state, that would be the safest option and the better option for the Sudanese people. I think they deserve to live a dignified life. They deserve human rights. They deserve even better than human rights. And it's so sad to see the atrocities that are being committed right over there. It makes you enraged. It makes you enraged that how could you see bodies being piled up like that and nobody's doing anything about it, you know? But then again, that is also because of these factions. They live off this pain. And so when you realize that, you say, okay, maybe that's not the goal. Maybe their goal wasn't to become a good nation or think of their people. It's more of a selfish goal that they have.
The UAE, both for signing the Abraham Accords, but also for its support for Somaliland, in general, mm-hmm. for its, I would say, very independent, very courageous, very paradigm-breaking approach,
yes.
has also received quite a lot of criticism from various parts of the Arab world, the Muslim world, the West as well. How does the UAE, has that criticism, and it also, I think, perhaps came after there were reports of that Israel also helped provide the UAE with air defense, with the Iron Dome system, with counter-drone systems. How does the UAE, how does you as a prominent Emirati commentator react or deal with that criticism?
I'm confident in our country's strategies, you know? So far, we're 50 plus years old, and every decision that has been taken from that point has been nothing but beneficial for us. So knowing that, I have full trust in our strategies that they will work out. So criticism doesn't mean much. I mean, I'll take the case of Somaliland. They've gotten countless of condemnations after condemnations, and that doesn't seem to be affecting them at all. They're still progressing. They still have an embassy in Israel. and they appointed an ambassador and all of that. So relations are moving. And so that's how I see the UAE as well. The relations are moving, whether there is criticism or not. At the end of the day, the UAE puts its people first and its national interests first. And we play it out however we see fits.
You know, I heard on a different podcast that you're a big fan of Hamilton, which I'm a huge fan as well. But I know, and one of the things that I really like about Hamilton is, you know, that line, I'm just like my country, young, scrappy, and hungry. And that may have been true for the United States, you know, 250 years ago. I think it's very true for Israel and the UAE today, in the sense that we're both still young countries. We're still writing our stories. We're still developing. And when I went to the UAE for the first few times, what I was amazed by is about how many people I met, how many young Emiratis I met, who their goal was to contribute to their country's development.
Yes.
Which I think is fantastic. And I think that you see that in Israel, perhaps not so much on the governmental level, more on the sort of national state building level. But what I do think is in both countries, you have this, somebody who wants to has the opportunity to be involved in building the next level, the next floor, the next chapter in the country's stories. And that's something that's remarkable that Israel and the UAE have in common.
Yes. I'm a huge fan of Hamilton, actually. I've watched it a couple of times, more times than I'd like to admit. Fun fact, actually, when I was writing my book, Andalusian, I did quote Hamilton. I didn't quote it in my book because I didn't know about the copyright situation. But in the draft itself, I had young, scrappy, and hungry, the exact phrase. I had it in my book. And but then I just removed it because I was like, I don't know if there's a copyright situation with Disney, right? I don't know if they'd be like fine with it or not. So I just decided to scratch that all together. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Hamilton. Because I see the parallels, right? I speak personally. I wouldn't say for everyone else. But to me, when I saw that show, it moved something in me. You know, I'm like, I can feel it. Yes, I do want to contribute towards my country. I do want to do something, even if it's not at a governmental level, even if it's a cultural level, a tourism level. Let's say, binding people together, having them come over, and we do cultural exchanges and all of that. It's something that I'm really passionate about. And yeah, I think drawing the parallels from Hamilton, it's sort of motivated me to keep going and to keep fighting for what I feel is right. And what is right to me is to defend my country, to put my country first, and to put my national identity in the forefront of everything I do. Yeah, that's just the general feeling I have when it comes to Hamilton. I love it so much. I almost quoted it, guys, in my book.
No, it's a bit, my kids also really got into it. So we were in visiting New York a year ago. I surprised them. I bought them tickets to the show on Broadway. It was amazing. Rauda, it's so fantastic to have you on the podcast. People who want to follow you, where's the best place for them to follow you?
Follow me on X. It's Formula Rauda on X.
And it's good that you had that name so that when you go back to racing, you're ready.
It's there, guys. I miss it. I have to go back soon.
I hope that we get to meet in person in the UAE or maybe here in Israel or maybe in Somaliland. I really look forward to that.
Yes. Hopefully. Would love.
Or in Tehran after the revolution and after it joins the Abraham Accords.
We'll see. If they sign the Abraham Accords, correct. Yes.
Thanks so much for joining me. It was really great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening. Please make sure to like, follow, and subscribe Mideast Horizons wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow the Miskav Institute, Israel's leading national security policy institute, at www.miskavins.org and across social media. You can send your comments, questions, suggestions to Mideast Horizons Podcast at gmail.com. And we'll see you next time.